Hey, Unchained listeners. As you know, it's hard keeping up with the fast-paced world of crypto, so we've got just the thing for you. Subscribe to our free Unchained Daily newsletter at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. You'll get the latest crypto news and original articles from our reporters, as well as summaries of other happenings in bullet points, plus our meme of the day, all curated and written by our amazing team. It's still your no-hype resource for all things crypto, just in newsletter form. Sign up at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Again, the URL is unchainedcrypto.substack.com.
Not a dividend.
It's a tale of two coins.
Now, your losses are on someone else's balance sheet.
Generally speaking, airdrops are kind of pointless anyways.
Unnamed trading firms who are very involved.
I like that ETH is the ultimate Ponzi.
DeFi protocols are the antidote to this problem.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Chopping Block. Every couple of weeks, the four of us get together and give the industry insider's perspective on the crypto topics of the day. Quick intros. First out, we got Tom, the DeFi maven and master of memes. Next out, we've got Robert, the crypto connoisseur and captain of Compound. Next, we've got Tarun, the Giga Brain and Grand Poobah at Gauntlet. And joining us today, special guest, we've got Pac-Man, the Baron of Blur. And then finally, you've got myself. I'm Haseeb, the head hype man at Dragonfly. So the four of us are early stage investors in crypto, but I want to caveat that nothing we say here is investment advice, legal advice, or even life advice. Please see choppingblock.xyz for more information. So Pac-Man, great to have you on the show. I see you're here in flesh and bone. I assume that's what you really look like.
The real human Pac-Man, yep.
The real human Pac-Man. Usually I see that you don't present as yourself, but I'm glad for this show you've unveiled your true colors. Great to have you joining us, man.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
It's got to have been a crazy week for you. So quick, by way of background, Pac-Man is one of the founders of Blur. He is operating pseudonymously. I want to caveat before we get into the show that Dragonfly, we are investors in the Blur token. So we're, full disclosures. But this, it's basically been within the last week that the Blur airdrop has gone live and the token has started trading. And you guys are now by far the biggest publicly tradable NFT token. How does it feel? This must be absolutely crazy for you.
Yeah, it's been absolutely incredible. Definitely very satisfied with the results so far.
Fair enough. Satisfied is a good answer.
Wow, that sounds like an earnings call type of phrase.
Robert, you're the only other person here who's had a token launch besides Tom and his meme token. Robert, you're the only other one who's had like a real legit token launch. I don't know because I've never had that experience and I hope never to because it sounds horrifying.
Wait, there's no Dragonfly token? When's the Dragonfly airdrop?
You guys are definitely eligible when it's live, but so far we're we don't want to reveal too much about the criteria for mining it. But what does it feel like? Tell me what it's like to launch a token. What does it feel like?
Yeah, honestly, it's mainly exhaustion. You know, in the 48 hours leading up to the token launch, I literally did not sleep. So it was like 5 a.m. and we were slated for a 9 a.m. PT, 12 p.m. ET token launch. And there was just still some like final to-dos to finish up. So I was like, okay, I'm going to try to like sleep for 30 minutes, close my eyes for 30 minutes, could not sleep, woke up, had a coffee, went through the token launch. We delayed 90 minutes, of course, and then launched. And it was just like absolutely insane. Everything held up, which was phenomenal. And then I had a few interviews later in the day and still was not able to sleep until probably around like 3, 4 a.m. that evening. So first time in my life that I stayed up for 48 hours straight, which was quite interesting.
No, wow, that's intense. Robert, what was the day that you launched Comp Token like? It was a very different time.
You know, I don't even remember at this point. It was so many years ago. You know, I just remember, the excitement of wondering what would happen next, right? And wondering, how would it get used? And wondering, when would it get used? And wondering, was there a bug? At that point, most of the code was tested, but new. And at this point, governance tokens and governance systems are, run of the mill. But really, it was just a sense of just like wondering, what would happen next? Because it was, in 2020, it was, a very different era and there was a lot less tokens being launched. And so, I feel like, for anyone that's gone through the process, it's, it's mostly just like, curious, observation.
And does it feel like it's different to launch token today than it was back then? Or is it basically the same like adrenaline rush as it must have been in 2020?
Well, in 2020 it was scary, right? Because like there was, you know, so many fewer of them. You know, now I feel like, you know, there's a playbook, you know, and granted, you know, everyone innovates on the playbook and Blur is not doing it the exact same way as everyone else does, you know, but then it was anxiety, you know, inducing.
I can imagine. Okay. Well, so speaking of the playbook, so I wanted to kind of structure this episode as a bit of a case study because Blur has been one of the most incredible kind of developments of a new product in crypto. And there's a lot of really interesting things you guys have done strategically to break into the NFT market, the market of NFT marketplaces. So I'm gonna do a little bit of setup before we jump into kind of getting your perspective around the strategy of how you've done Blur. But a lot of people I think who are listening probably don't know that much about Blur or even about the history of how Blur came to be. And so the history of that really starts with OpenSea. So OpenSea, I think everybody in crypto knows OpenSea, the largest NFT platform historically. They basically had a monopoly going into essentially, you know, mid-2022. They were the dominant platform by far when NFTs really kicked off in late 2020. Last year, they did $21 billion in GMV. They had over $500 million in fees, raised enormous amounts of capital at really crazy valuations. And OpenSea, historically, they always enforced royalties. And royalties are going to be kind of at the center of a lot of the conversation and the strategy that Blur really innovated on. So for a lot of people, so we had a big debate about royalties on the Chopping Block. This was like, I don't know, 3 months ago, back when Magic Eden first turned off royalties. And for those of you who didn't catch that, royalties are basically when anytime there's a trade of an NFT, if you enforce royalties, that basically means that you're enforcing a percentage of that trade as a fee to go back to the NFT issuer. So if Yuga Labs, they're the issuer of Bored Apes. If you trade a Bored Ape, then if this marketplace is enforcing royalties, they will take, you know, X percent of that trade and they'll send it back to Yuga Labs as a sort of fee for anytime their collection is traded. And historically, these were always enforced. Now, royalties, though, are not enforceable at the protocol layer. There is no way to enforce royalties directly in the code. And this is kind of the weird thing about royalties that a lot of people don't understand. Royalties are actually more of a norm than they are something embedded into the software. So now this norm has always been enforced basically because, you know, in part because OpenSea just dominated the market. And everybody kind of understood that, like, well, you know, this is part of the ethos of NFTs is that you do these royalty things and it's all good. But then came PseudoSwap. PseudoSwap was the first really dominant NFT marketplace that did not enforce royalties. It was an AMM, and the AMMs just, you know, they just decided not to do royalties. And they started gaining a lot of market share. That pushed Magic Eden to start not enforcing royalties. And that triggered the conversation that we had about this big NFT royalty debate. And then OpenSea finally felt the pressure to do something. But what they did was very interesting. What they did was that they allowed you to continue enforcing royalties on OpenSea only if you blocked competitors that did not enforce royalties. So Pacman, talk us through what that was like. When you guys saw OpenSea going through this move, what did you think? How did you understand what they were doing strategically? Because Blur was already live at that point.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. You know, you're totally right that it kicked off with Sudo, and it's somewhat of basically a prisoner's dilemma when it comes to royalty enforcement across marketplaces. And Sudo was kind of the first defector, you know, in the space. And what happened from there was within a month of Sudo's launch, Gem, which is actually owned by OpenSea, integrated Sudo into its aggregator. And Gem at the time was the leading marketplace aggregator, NFT aggregator, basically it lets you, you know, buy listings across marketplaces. You know, Blur is now the largest aggregator and marketplace by far, but at the time Gem was the largest and they integrated Sudo. And it was quite a surprising move because from our perspective, it seemed to be antithetical to OpenSea's entire position. It seemed like it would cannibalize their own business. Why would you, you know, actively support a protocol that is, you know, circumventing a fee that you're adding into your own marketplace? And it was very clear to us that it would kickstart this domino effect that would be, you know, something that the entire space in general didn't want. So what happened after was, after Gem integrated Sudo, within 3 days, X2Y2, which was another leading marketplace at the time, prior to Blur's launch, they went to optional royalties immediately. And they cited Gem's move as the reason for why. And then now both of those marketplaces were gaining share, you know, due to a lower fee structure. And we launched, and basically our goal was to pull traders away from those zero royalty marketplaces by giving them a carrot. And the carrot was, we're going to give a larger airdrop to traders who honor some royalties, at least, compared to honor no royalties. And then, you know, within a few weeks, there were a few hot collections that launched that Blur ended up winning a lot of volume on. And then OpenSea came out with this approach. And it was somewhat surprising to us because there are two reasons why it was surprising. One was it fundamentally altered the culture of the space, where it suddenly became okay for collection creators to put in, you know, whitelists or blacklists into the native asset, the NFT itself, basically introduce centralization into the underlying asset. And that was just, to us, such a slippery slope that was basically against the entire ethos of this space. You know, if you're going to introduce centralization in that way, why not just trade a JPEG on a server and, you know, you can pay with ETH and, you know, like it gets you the same thing. You can enforce royalties that way. But it kind of just like went against what we felt was really awesome about NFTs, which is this, you know, permissionless asset that can trade anywhere around the world 24/7. Once you own it, you own it. It's yours to do with it what you want. And so they introduced this and they basically made it okay for the collections to, you know, basically start introducing centralization into the underlying asset. And then not only did it do this, but also we know from DeFi that you can't really enforce these types of restrictions at a technical level. Like, if there's always workarounds. You can always create like wrappers, you can do code golf. Like, you know, people have tried to make tokens that can't go below a certain value and it's like, it never works. So many of these attempts have been made in DeFi already. And, you know, at the end of the day, whether you're restricting an ERC-20 or an ERC-721, they're all just tokens that you're restricting. You know, NFTs at a technical level, you know, they're still assets on Ethereum. So it was clear to us that, okay, this could be an effective temporary measure, but it's not an effective long-term measure. And at this, you know, while ineffective, they also just kind of permanently changed the culture of the space at the same time. So it just kind of seemed like a double whammy. That was very unfortunate. We at the time actually adopted that policy within a week because we saw that, you know, obviously OpenSea at the time was the leading marketplace. It was very clear that there'd be a shift from the creators. Like, if you just think about from like an EV perspective, like, you know, a collection creator basically has to adopt OpenSea's like filter policy. And then, you know, if the royalties were going to be enforced in a temporary state, we might as well, you know, play along in the prisoner's dilemma and cooperate because, you know, as long as for us, as long as there was something that was being adhered to at a cultural level, we thought it was reasonable for us to continue to enforce royalties on those collections until, you know, until someone defected again, effectively. So we adopted it, but it didn't really make sense to us.
Wait, so when you adopted it, did OpenSea remove you from that default block list?
No, actually, it was really funny. They did not, because, you know, when we adopted it, we said, we'll adopt it for collections that incorporate this filter, but for collections that don't incorporate this filter, and including existing collections, like older collections like Azuki or Bored Apes, you know, these were really decentralized assets, right? That's, you know, one of the reasons why we think that they're still the blue chips, is that they're really these decentralized assets. And they didn't have any sort of way to restrict the trading. So they could still trade on Sudo. They could still trade on XCY2. So when we considered that, it just didn't make sense to enforce the full royalties on those collections, because it was obvious that the traders who are very price sensitive, they would go to, you know, those alternative venues. But they, OpenSea basically said, because Blur isn't doing that, they're not going to be removed from the filter list.
I see. So even though you guys are trying to play nice, they're like, no, screw Blur. Like, we're not going to take them off. I think a lot of people who are listening to this conversation who are not very deep in NFTs might be confused about why we keep talking about royalties, 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 royalties. It seems like royalties is like at the heart of this big conflict between all the big marketplaces in NFTs. Maybe just to kind of build the intuition. Why are royalties so fraught? Why are they so important? Why are people arguing about them? Because we're not talking about fees, right? Fees are also another element of it, which is that, you know, OpenSea has the highest take rate of any of the NFT exchanges. But the big fight has been over royalties. Why do you think it is that royalties are this giant battleground?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is path dependency, to be honest. You know, the way the NFT culture started was PFPs, like larger collections, they weren't the norm. It was initially like one of one art, you know, like small batch collections. And for like one of one artists, you know, this whole concept of royalties made a lot of sense because collectors of those collections, they have a very personal relationship with the art, and they have a personal relationship with the artists. And they'll oftentimes want to pay the royalty because they want to honor the artists and help sustain them. It's a really beautiful thing. PFP collections, as they got big, it kind of became the norm to still have the royalties. And it kind of became like the default way that a lot of these collections would monetize, not from like a total monetary perspective, but from like a cultural perspective. So, you know, if you look at like Yuga Labs, for example, like they make most of their money off of the mints, and actually a very small proportion of the money that they've made has been off of the royalties. But I think it just kind of became the norm for everyone to expect. When we looked at the market, it seemed rather suboptimal from a value capture perspective for the collection creators, to be honest, because, you know, in any sort of financial market, any increase in take rates results in a nonlinear decrease in trading volume. If you decrease the take rates, you can have significantly more trading volume, you can have tighter spreads, more liquidity. There's a lot of things. And then there's a lot of things that can only happen once you have more liquidity. And it felt to us like the space was kind of being held back by this norm that wasn't actually long-term optimal, but it was the norm because that's kind of how the space started effectively.
That makes sense. Okay. So there's a lot of kind of cultural path dependence to how royalties played out and how they became such an important battleground, both symbolically, financially, and even emotionally for why all these exchanges were fighting with each other over this concept of royalties and trying to enforce them on chain through blacklisting each other and doing all this other complicated stuff.
You could argue that royalties were sort of like liquidity mining for artists, in that it like attracted artists at a certain time, you know, in 2021, where you're basically arguing that they got this like annuity that would, you know, be there perpetually. And that's why you should put your art in an NFT. And I think like what there's just some point at which it became an unreasonable subsidy relative to like market friction. Also, by the way, Steve, we all know this episode is your victory lap episode.
Oh, we'll get to that. Sorry, go ahead, Tom.
No, I totally agree. I think from my conversations with artists and galleries, a lot of them initially viewed, you know, because digital art has been around for a while, but a lot of them viewed the, you know, attraction of NFTs as, you know, A, reaching a bigger market, but also getting access to the secondaries. It was kind of sort of a very like semi-famous moment where, like, not an artist, but Mark Cuban was talking about tokenizing, you know, Cavs tickets and letting them trade on like an NFT exchange. And then someone was like, no, like, you can't enforce the royalties on chain. And he's like, wait, what's the point of the tokenization then if I don't get, you know, the secondaries fees? And so it's like, I think even, you know, somewhat sophisticated people sort of missed this point.
Wait. Are we calling Mark Cuban, who lost a lot of his money in Iron Finance, the sophisticated person here? Just checking.
I'm trying to be kind on the pod today.
So the other thing that always struck me as strange about this story about royalties, and I'm trying not to take too much of a victory lap because I did predict that this would happen, but the thing that also struck me as strange is that crypto, you know, in crypto we find a way to tokenize almost everything. Right, pretty much anything that can be on chain, we find some way to break it down into tokens and trade it. But for some reason, people never did that to royalties. They never tokenized their royalty stream and then sold it to third parties. There were a few projects that did this here and there, but it wasn't widespread. It wasn't common. But this seems like the obvious way to understand what royalties are, right? Like when an artist, you know, ends up working with a music label, what they do is they end up basically selling off vast majority of their royalties to the label, right? In order to basically get an upfront payment to allow them to go create art or whatever, take away most of their risk. If NFT artists had done this, what they would find is that actually you can just sell this off for a lump sum payment and basically sell it. You know, you could have sold it to the exchange in the first place. So there's nothing about even the nature of royalties that guarantees that they're structured as an annuity. If you just sold it off upfront, which, you know, you could in principle, then I think the norms would have